we need to recognize that this Bible is really a book of science. Many people have the idea today that the Bible is full of scientific mistakes, and that it's not a book of science at all, but rather a book of religion at best. But we maintain that the Bible is a book of science, that it does have the basic principles of science, the basic principles of every science, and that whenever it deals with science, as it does frequently deal with natural phenomena, always the references will be found to be scientifically correct. Now, from the biblical data, we can build a what we call a creation model within which to interpret the data of science. And once we build that model, then we can proceed to interpret the data of science without any reference to the Bible. And that's really what I want to do today, to show you that the facts of science without reference to the Bible do fit the biblical model of creation. On the other hand, we can develop an evolution model which interprets and correlates all the data of science within a naturalistic framework. They're really these two worldviews that deal with all processes, all systems, and one finally makes a choice as to which he wants to believe, because neither one is capable of being tested in the laboratory. They are events of the past which can't be reproduced in the present. But we maintain that the creation model will fit the facts of science more directly, by far, than will the evolution model, which has to be continually expanded and modified to make it fit the facts. Now, I want to begin by quoting a man who is an opponent of creationism. In fact, in the past number of years, there have been maybe 40 books or more written against the modern creationist revival, because there has been a revival of interest in creationism taking place among scientists as well as among other people in general. And so there have been many books written against us. And this particular book is written by Dr. Douglas Fatima. It's called Science on Trial. And although I don't agree with much of what's in the book, this statement is correct. And let me read what he says. He says, "Creation and evolution between them exhaust the possible explanations for the origin of living things. Organisms either appeared on the earth fully developed or they did not. If they did not, they must have developed from pre-existing species by some process of modification. If they did appear in a fully developed state, then they must indeed have been created by some omnipotent intelligence." So these are the two possibilities. Either we can explain all things in terms of natural processes which are still going on and which we can observe today, or we cannot, one or the other. Those are the two possibilities. And if we cannot, then some processes and some basic systems in nature, at least, must be explained in terms of supernatural processes which were completed in the past and are not going on in the present. We maintain that the latter model will fit the facts. The first model will not fit the facts without much modification and expansion to make it fit the exceptions and the contradictions. Now we need to define our terms. And so for the evolution model, I want to use the definition of Sir Julian Huxley, which would certainly be authoritative. Sir Julian Huxley was probably the world's leading evolutionist until he died a number of years ago. He was the architect of what's called Neo-Darwinism. He was a grandson of Thomas Huxley, who was known as Charles Darwin's bulldog back in his day. He was the first director general of UNESCO, and he was the one selected to be the keynote speaker at the great Darwinian Centennial Convocation at the University of Chicago in 1959. So certainly this definition ought to be authoritative, and Sir Julian makes the emphasis that this is a worldview, not simply a biological theory, as many people think. He says evolution in the extended sense can be defined as a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. And then he says, our present knowledge indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, one single process of self-transformation. The whole of reality is evolution. Everything is in this process of evolution from lower levels to higher levels of organization and complexity and variety. And note that he does not allow the possibility that there's a God out there who is directing this process. He says it's a process of self-transformation. So the universe is transforming itself by its own properties and processes into higher levels of organization and complexity. Now that's the evolution model, and that can be illustrated, I think, graphically by a chart which shows the increase of order with time. If you look at the chart, you'll find that the horizontal scale represents time and the vertical scale represents organization or complexity or order. And we start way back in the beginning with primeval chaos, random particles of some sort, evolving into complex molecules and then into living molecules and finally into complex living beings, finally human beings, and who knows what in the future. So there's a tremendous increase in complexity over the ages by the evolution model. Creation model, on the other hand, is exactly the opposite. It starts out with everything perfect and then goes down, so that it's exactly the opposite of the evolution model. Now, the idea here, of course, is if there is a creator, who is able to create the universe, he knows what he's doing and is able to do it right, so he makes things perfect to begin with. And since you cannot improve perfection, any vertical change will have to go downward. And as time goes on then, there will be a decrease of complexity and organization and order. At the very most, it will be horizontal at the same level, but never can it go upward because there is no possibility of improving perfection. And the Creator made things right to begin with. So these are two opposite models, and therefore they certainly lend themselves to comparison in terms of their ability to correlate scientific data. Now you can sort of summarize the implication of the two models. In the creation model, we postulate a self-existing creator God able to create a universe. In the evolutionary worldview, we postulate a self-existing, organizing, evolving cosmos, evolving by itself. In the creation model, we say that the universe was created by divine fiat. God just spoke and it happened because he is omnipotent. In the evolutionary worldview, the universe is organized by itself, by its own systems, processes. And then we can say in the creation worldview that the basic systems of the world, the basic kinds of organisms, the basic laws of nature, the basic structure of the universe, was completed in the past by supernatural processes which are not going on now, and therefore we can't observe them scientifically in the laboratory today. On the other hand, the evolutionary worldview says that all systems have developed by natural processes which are still continuing in the present, and therefore we ought to be able to see them operating today, and therefore study them and test them and see how they work today. And then finally, any net changes in the creation worldview would be downward. Now, there could be horizontal changes at the same level of complexity, but any net changes towards a different level of complexity would have to go downward, whereas in the evolutionary worldview, the net change is upward because we've gone all the way from primeval particles to complex people. So the net change has been vertically upward in the evolutionary worldview. Now, these lend themselves, therefore, very nicely to comparison in terms of their relative ability to correlate the scientific data. And so let's consider, first of all, the present world, then the past world, and then the possible world. In the present world, which supposedly is the one which science can deal with, because the very essence of the scientific method is observation and experimentation and reproducibility of the experiment, so it deals with the present primarily. In the present worldview, is there any obvious evidence of evolution taking place, either at the level of the universe itself, the stars and the galaxies, or the level of living things at the other end of the spectrum? And the answer is no. There's no evidence whatever that any vertical change is ever taking place. Here's just one of the photographs which could be taken more or less at random from the many photographs taken by our giant telescopes. I think this was from Palomar, giving an insight into the tremendous magnitude and size of the universe. I remember back in the days before the telescope was invented, people could only see about 4,000 or 5,000 stars. The Bible, on the other hand, it said that there were innumerable stars, and now our telescopes show that that's the case. There just seemed to be no limit to the size and scope and extent of the universe as far as we're able to discern in astronomy. Well, this is a photograph which indicates the size and the scope of the universe, but now note this. As long as people have been looking at the stars, if this photograph had been taken 1,000 years ago, it would be essentially the same thing. If it's taken 1,000 years in the future, it would be the same. The stars do not change. As long as people have been observing the stars, no one has ever observed any kind of star evolving into a different kind of star, or one type of galaxy evolving into a different galaxy. The only changes that we see in astronomy are in the direction of deterioration, in accordance with the creation model. There are some stars that explode and disintegrate, and meteorites break up and disintegrate. But no one has ever seen any kind of a star or planet or anything else in the sky evolve into a more complex system at all. Normally what you see is stability. The Creator, having created the way things the way they should be, sees that they stay that way. And that's what we see at the world of the extremely big. Now when we come to the extremely small, say to the tiniest molecule of life, no one ever sees life evolving from non-life. When people try to produce that in the laboratory, but nobody's ever been able to do it, no one's ever seen it happen. So the new evidence that life is evolving from non-life today, and if we get into the range of living systems, no one sees any evolution there either. Let me return, though, for just a moment to the alternate evolutionary worldviews of the stars and of living things. As far as the stars are concerned and the universe itself, the common view today is that known as the Big Bang Theory. Now, there have been other theories of origins of the universe in the past, but the one which is most popular today is the Big Bang Theory, which says about 18 billion years or so ago, the universe began in a primeval explosion, the Big Bang, which generated from primeval particles, finally hydrogen and helium, and then from that everything else has evolved. It is interesting, just in passing, to note that in the Big Bang Theory, the main evidence for that is the primeval radiation, which supposedly permeates the universe on an equal basis everywhere. Dr. Victor Weisskopf of the faculty at MIT, former professor of physics there and head of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, in an article in the American Scientist, published in 1983, makes a very interesting comment about the Big Bang Theory. He says, indeed, the Judeo-Christian tradition describes the beginning of the world in a way that is surprisingly similar to the scientific model. Previously, it seemed scientifically unsound to have light created before the sun. And you know, many people who object to the Genesis record of creation say, how could you have light on the first day and you don't have the sun until the fourth day? Well, he says the present scientific view indeed does assume the early universe to be filled with various kinds of radiation and light, long before the sun was created. The Bible says about the beginning, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light that it was good. So you see, if the evolutionist in with his Big Bang view finds no problem in having light before the sun, well, I don't think we necessarily have to do that with our Genesis model either. However, I was going to avoid reference to the Bible, and I referred that to that only because he did. Now, as far as the Big Bang theory itself is concerned, although that's the popular theory, more and more scientists are beginning to object to it and find fallacies in it. Actually, it's completely unscientific. It contradicts many of the basic laws of science. And so many of the most prominent astronomers are now beginning to reject it and maybe go back to some form of the steady state theory. But in order to get away from the objections to the Big Bang theory, people have developed what they call the inflationary model of the universe. And that says that before the Big Bang took place, there was a primeval period of inflation where the universe inflated rapidly in what they call a cold big whoosh, about the size of a grapefruit, which was then followed by the hot Big Bang. But this is a very recent article by Dr. Harold Puthoff, who is a professor of theoretical physics at the Institute for Advanced Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. He says, now to the biggest question of all, where did the universe come from? Or in modern terminology, what started the Big Bang? Could quantum fluctuations of empty space have something to do with this as well? Edward Tyron of the City University of New York thought so in 1973 when he proposed that our universe may have originated as a fluctuation of the vacuum on a large scale as simply one of those things that happen from time to time. And that's an amazing theory, seems to me. The universe doesn't have any explanation. It just happened. It just evolved suddenly out of nothing by a quantum fluctuation in a primeval vacuum. Then he goes on to say, this idea was later refined and updated within the context of inflationary cosmology. They proposed that the universe was created by quantum tunneling from literally nothing into the something we call the universe. Although highly speculative, these models indicate that physicists find themselves turning again to the void and fluctuations therein for their answers. Well, highly speculative indeed. I would say I would call it absurd to say that you can have nothing evolve into something without any explanation. And you see, really, it's an ad hoc proposition to try to explain the universe without God. Now, people used to say that it was rather absurd for creationists to believe in creation out of nothing. But at least we postulate a creator capable of creating a universe. But now we have the theory of the universe evolving out of nothing when there's nothing to explain it. And this, of course, completely goes against the basic scientific premise of cause and effect and of the basic laws of thermodynamics and conservation of momentum, and many other basic laws of science are contradicted by the idea. So many people are now giving it up again. And as far as the other parts of the universe are concerned, like the planets and the stars and the galaxies, how did they evolve? Well, I think this is an interesting statement from one of the leading men in this field, Dr. Steven Weinberg, in an article in Science Magazine, 1985. Says, among the most important relics are the structures we see in the sky. Many stars are grouped into clusters. The clusters themselves, along with these, with loose stars like our sun, are grouped into galaxies. And the galaxies themselves are grouped into clusters of galaxies. Okay, that's a fact of science. Nobody would question that. But then he says, a great disappointment of modern astrophysics has been that we still do not have a clear and detailed understanding of how these structures were formed. Clear and detailed, indeed, they don't have any idea. They have all kinds of confusing theories about that. He says, we don't even know whether the smaller structures formed first and then coalesced into the larger ones, or whether the larger structures formed first and then broke up into the smaller ones. I don't really know anything about how these things evolved. And then he says, it's a little bit disturbing that all these estimates of the ages and compositions of the stars rest on elaborate calculations of what is going on inside of them, but all we observe is the light from their surfaces. So all of this is strictly speculative to try to get away from the concept of creation. But after all, if we allow the possibility that there is a creator who created the universe, he was able to create it fully functioning right from the beginning. The Bible indicates that's exactly what he did. And he's going to see that it stays that way. And of course, as long as people have been looking at the stars, they've been just like they are. Nobody's ever seen one evolve into another. Now, as far as living things are concerned, let me read a statement from Dr. Colin Patterson. Dr. Colin Patterson says that there's been no example of a living species evolving into a different one. Here he says, now Dr. Patterson is one of the leading evolutionists of the world at the British Museum of Natural History, and he says no one has ever produced a species by mechanisms of natural selection. No one's ever gotten near to it. That's interesting because Charles Darwin, 150 years ago, postulated an explanation for the origin of species. He called it the origin of species by natural selection. And he's been world famous ever since, but now many years later, with thousands of scientists doing tests on this and developing mechanisms and trying to see this happen, they say that no one's ever yet been able to see it happen. So they don't know how new species originate. No one's ever been able to do it by natural selection or any other method. Now, someone might say, well, what about the peppered moth? Isn't that an example of evolution in action? Now, this is the most popular example, which is cited in the textbooks, of evolution taking place today. The peppered moth, which once was a light-colored moth, evolved into a dark-colored moth. With the advance of the Industrial Revolution and the study tree trunks, which made the light-colored moth easy to pick off by the predators, the birds, so it evolved into the dark coloration, which made it more difficult to find. And now that the atmosphere is clearing up over there a little bit, it's evolving back in the other direction again. Well, this is an example of the peppered moth. And the fact is, however, that although this is variation, this is not evolution. Now, you have to understand there's a difference between variation at the same level of complexity and evolution into a higher level of complexity. Sometimes people call that microevolution and macroevolution, but a better term is simply variation versus evolution. Variation is at the same level of complexity, and that's what the peppered moth did. Let me read a statement from Dr. L. Harrison Matthews, who's a fellow of the Royal Society, one of the leading zoologists of Great Britain. And first of all, he says this, in accepting evolution as a fact, how many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct? Or remember that the theory of animal evolution has never been thus proved. Now, people will say that evolution is a proved fact of science. Dr. Matthews says it is not. It's a belief. He says the fact of evolution is the backbone of biology, but biology is in the peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? Belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present is capable of proof. I say, who is Dr. Matthews? Well, he wrote this statement in the foreword to the 1971 edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. He's a leading evolutionary zoologist of Great Britain. And then he goes on to say with respect to the peppered moth, he says, the peppered moth experiments beautifully demonstrate natural selection, survival of the fittest, in action. They see no creation subjects to the idea of natural selection. It keeps things the way they were intended to be by God to begin with. Survival of the fittest. When an animal goes through a mutation which makes it less viable and less able to survive, why, it will not preserve its deformity or its defect in its progeny because it won't survive. So we believe in that. But he says the peppered moth experiments demonstrate that, but they do not show evolution in progress. For however the population may alter in their content of light, intermediate, or dark forms, all the moths remain from beginning to end, Biston betularia, which is the name of the species of moth. So whether it's light or dark or in between, it's still the same species. Hasn't evolved into a different species. Certainly hasn't evolved into some other kind of moth or butterfly or something else. It's the same old species of moth. And so that isn't evolution, in spite of the fact that that's the most frequent example cited of evolution occurring today. People have tried to figure out how evolution works. Natural selection is beginning to lose favor, and so other mechanisms have been proposed, but let me read what Dr. Keith Stewart Thompson of Yale University says about that. This was another article written against creationism, so he's an evolutionist, but then he does say this. Now, Dr. Thompson, by the way, is professor of biology and dean of the graduate school at Yale University. And he says, evolution is both troubled from without by the nagging insistence of anti-scientists, by which he means creationists, and nagged from within by the troubling complexities of genetic and developmental mechanisms, and new questions about the central mystery, speciation itself. Swee says that the central mystery of biology is still how new species form, speciation. Darwin didn't solve the problem after all, and nobody else has since. Nobody knows how evolution works. Nobody's ever seen it in action. Nobody's ever seen it happen. You think they'd begin to question whether it's true or not. Matter of fact, what we do see in the world is extinction, deterioration, and extinction according with the creation model. We see, for example, organisms atrophy. We see organisms become extinct. In fact, Dr. Norman Myers, in an article in Bioscience in January 18, 1989, a very recent article on extinction, he says, today's rate can be estimated through various analytical techniques to be a minimum of 1,000 and possibly several thousand species per year. In other words, what's happening in the living world is species are becoming extinct at the rate of at least 1,000 a year, and that's been going on through human history back, say, 4,000 or 5,000 years. A tremendous number of species have become extinct, and in all that length of time, nobody has ever seen a new species evolve. If evolution is taking place, it seems like it's going in the wrong direction. I think we can conclude that as far as the observable processes of real science in the present are concerned, evolution simply is not taking place. Nobody's ever seen it happen. Nobody knows how it works. It simply doesn't happen in the present world. Well, so the evolutionists say what you need to do is to go to the fossil world of the past. Now let me quote from Dr. Pierre Grasset of France. He's one of the leading evolutionists of Europe, probably the leading zoologist in Europe. He held the chair of evolution at the great Sorbonne University in Paris for 30 years. In his book on evolution, Evolution of Living Organisms is the title of it, published in 1977, he says, today our duty is to destroy the myth of evolution if it's considered as a simple, understood, and explained phenomenon unfolding before us. Now, he thinks that evolution has stopped, and that's why we don't see it take place today. He still is an evolutionist because he believes it took place in the past. And so what he says is, naturalists must remember that the process of evolution is revealed only through fossil forms. A knowledge of paleontology is therefore prerequisite. Only paleontology can provide us with the evidence of evolution and reveal its course or its mechanisms. So he says you've got to go to the record of fossils to see any evidence of evolution. Now, fossils, you know, are remains of former living things. They may be shells or they may be bones. May even be footprints. Whatever evidence we can find of the type of living things that lived in the past that has now been preserved in the rocks of the crust of the earth, usually in the sedimentary rocks of what's known as the geological column, the rock formations of the earth's crust, we find these fossils. And the idea is that as you go down into these rocks, you can find evidence of evolution there in the fossil record, even though we don't see it today. And they say what you have to realize is that evolution goes so slowly, you really can't see it today. It takes millions of years to produce evolution towards higher complexity, real macroevolution. And for that, you have to go to the fossil record, where presumably we do have the millions of years preserved for us in this record in the rocks. Well, that sounds convincing, and that is the main evidence for evolution, and we are not going to take the time to go into that in detail today. Dr. Gish has a very fine book, I think it's the best book on the subject, called Evolution, the Challenge of the Fossil Record, and he does show there that at all levels, there are no evolutionary forms anywhere in the fossil record. What we have in the fossil record are exactly the same sorts of things we have today. That is, we have cats and we have dogs, but we have nothing in between cats and dogs. Now, somebody might say, well, wasn't there a dat that was formed a number of years ago? Yeah, there's a picture of it. The dat, that's a hybrid dog and cat. Half dog, half cat. And of course, when that picture was published in the San Diego newspaper a number of years ago, a lot of my evolutionist friends sent it to me because I'd been saying that was impossible. Each kind reproduces its own kind, and so you can't have one kind become a different kind. And here it looks like you can, because the cat and the dog can produce a hybrid, and that means that they probably came from the same ancestor. Well, sounds kind of convincing, but what most people didn't see about 3 days later in the inside of the newspaper, so on the front page, like this was, a little half-inch column in which the publisher of that photograph admitted that was a hoax. I don't quite know how he made that thing, but he said it was a hoax. There's no such thing as a dat or a cog. Cats are cats and dogs are dogs, and although there are many varieties of cats and many varieties of dogs, why, there's nothing in between a cat and a dog. And as you go into the fossil record, you'll find maybe some extinct dogs and extinct cats. But again, you don't find anything in between a dog and a cat or any common ancestor leading up to the dog on one hand and the cat on the other. So we don't find these transitional forms in the fossils any more than in the present world. Dr. Stephen Stanley, a man who's an expert in paleontology has written on macroevolution, a whole book, and this statement is taken from that book. He says, the known fossil record fails to document a single example of phyletic evolution accomplishing a major morphological transition. Hence, it offers no evidence that the gradualistic model can be valid. And so what Dr. Stanley thinks is that evolution took place in jumps. There's no gradual change from one kind to another, like Huxley and others had said, but took place in jumps without leaving any intermediate forms. Well, that's a convenient way to explain why you don't find the intermediate forms in the fossil record. But as a matter of fact, that isn't evidence. That's lack of evidence. It's an ad hoc assumption developed to explain the lack of evidence for evolution in the fossil record. It would be a lot better evidence if somebody could find these intermediate forms in the fossil record. But nobody's ever found any. And he says it fails to reveal a single example. Now, it doesn't reveal any example of this sudden evolution either. In fact, there's no known mechanism that could produce that. It certainly isn't happening today. Somebody might say, well, yeah, aren't there some transitional forms? What about Archaeopteryx? And of course, when we say that there are no transitional forms in the fossil record, what we find is that they will say, yes, there are transitional forms in the fossil record, and we ask what there are, and they will say Archaeopteryx. But as a matter of fact, Archaeopteryx is not an intermediate form between reptiles and birds. It's a true bird. And it is not a transitional form at best. It's an extinct bird, which can be called a mosaic creature rather than a transitional creature. That's what Dr. Stephen Gould at Harvard University calls it. He's probably the world's most articulate evolutionist and very much opposed to creationism. And he says that Archaeopteryx is not an example of a transitional form, but an example of a mosaic form. That means that all of its structures are fully functional and developed for its purpose in its own environment. Now, he says also that you can't even imagine a transitional form that would work. And, of course, that's true. You try to imagine, say, how a reptile could evolve into a bird going through intermediate stages, gradually becoming a bird from some sort of lizard or something. Now, Mark Ridley is professor of zoology at Oxford University. And another article written against creationism, he says this, in any case, no real evolutionist, whether he's a gradualist or a punctuationist, will use the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. So he says you can't use the fossil record to prove evolution. Well, remember Dr. Grasset said the only way you can get evidence of evolution is through the fossil record. So which one is right? Matter of fact, they're both right. Dr. Grasset is right. There's no evidence of evolution today, so if you're going to have evidence of evolution, it has to be in the fossil record. But Dr. Ridley is right because there isn't any evidence there. In other words, there's no evidence of evolution anywhere. There's no scientific evidence of evolution anywhere in the scientific world. That's not what you read in the textbooks or hear on the television, but that's the fact. No one has ever cited a real evidence of evolution, scientific evidence of evolution. Oh, variation, all right, like the peppered moth, but no one has ever cited one example of one species evolving into a higher species. In Darwin's book, The Origin of Species by Natural Selection, you can read the book from cover to cover, and you'll never find an example of a species which evolved into a higher species by natural selection. So there's no evidence for it. And on the other hand, what we see in both the living world and the fossil world is exactly what we would predict from our creation model. That is, we would predict that the Creator would create basic kinds of plants and animals with ability to vary horizontally within the kind so that it could adapt to different environments without becoming extinct. But it could not adapt into a different kind or into a higher kind. There may possibly be cases of degeneration into lower levels and finally extinction. But no real evolution anywhere in the present world or in the fossil world, and that's exactly what the creation model predicts. So the facts fit the creation model and not the evolution model, whether we're talking about the present or the past. And so you'd ask, well, then what is the evidence for evolution if there's none in the present or in the past? Well, Dr. Stephen Jay Gould at Harvard University, who is probably the leading evolutionist today, at least he's the most articulate and the sort of the spokesman for the evolutionary world. In an article dealing with that very thing, people ask him, what is the evidence for evolution? And he says, well, the main evidence, and here let me quote from his article in Natural History Magazine, 1987. He says, imperfections are the primary proofs that evolution has occurred. Imperfections. What he means by that is that organisms have defects in them, and that proves evolution. He says that proves that they were not created because the Creator would make them perfect. Well, yes, he would, but there's nothing in the creation model that says an organism having been created perfect has to stay perfect. Matter of fact, the creation model says that basically the trend is downward. So imperfections are exactly in accordance with the creation model, but what That does not give it as any evidence for evolution. The fact that an organism develops an imperfection doesn't explain at all how it got to be there in the first place. He uses as an example the panda's thumb. In fact, he has a whole book called The Panda's Thumb. But if you saw the pandas when they were here in San Diego several years ago, a couple years ago, I guess, you know that those pandas were not imperfect. Their thumb, which is not really a thumb like other animals, but sort of an extension of the wrist, served the panda very effectively, ideally for its purpose in its own environment. But even if it was an imperfection, it certainly isn't proof of evolution. But if that's the main evidence of evolution, then we would say evolution is in a bad way if it has to use that kind of evidence as the main evidence for evolution. I think we can finally ask the question, is evolution even possible? If we don't see any evidence today, don't see any evidence in the past, how do we know it's even possible? We think that's the question that evolutionists ought to be asking themselves. Matter of fact, the basic laws of science seem to indicate that it's not possible. Do you know that the basic laws of science are the laws of thermodynamics? Two basic laws. One is the first law, one the second law. First law of thermodynamics is the law of conservation of energy. And here I'm quoting from Isaac Asimov, who's probably the world's most prolific science writer. He's written over 400, probably 500 books, just about every field of science. And so he knows the field of science. And so when he writes this, he's writing as a scientist, but he is not writing as a creationist because he's an atheist. But he does say this with respect to this first law. He says, to express all this, we can say that energy can be transferred from one place to another or transformed from one form to another, but it can neither be created nor destroyed. It's also known as the law of the conservation of energy. Energy is the same as matter. Matter and energy are interchangeable. Energy is necessary to produce work, to produce anything that happens. Any process, anything that happens in the world of space and time involves conservation and transformations of energy. And so that's the basic law of science, and every natural process has to conform to that law, so far as we know. That tells us plainly that no creation is now taking place. It was an event of the past. No annihilation is taking place because the Creator is conserving what He created. So that although we can change forms and so on, we cannot create nor destroy any energy. Then he says, this law is considered the most powerful and fundamental generalization about the universe that scientists have ever been able to make. He does say this, no one knows why energy is conserved. That's a theological question. Scientifically, you can't answer the why questions. So nobody knows why energy has to be conserved. He says, no one can be completely sure it is truly conserved everywhere in the universe under all conditions. All anyone can say is that in over a century and a quarter of careful measurement, scientists have never been able to point to a definite violation of energy conservation, either in the heavens above or the atoms within, or in the familiar everyday surroundings. So this is a universal law of science, if there is such a thing. That's the first law of thermodynamics. And the second law, in the words of Harold Blum at Princeton University, also an evolutionist, biochemist, a major consequence of the second law of thermodynamics is that all real processes go toward a condition of greater probability. The probability function generally used in thermodynamics is entropy. Orderliness is associated with low entropy, randomness with high entropy. The second law of thermodynamics says, left to itself, any isolated system will go toward greater entropy, which means greater randomness and greater likelihood. Now, if you follow the technical jargon there, what he's saying, that everything tends to go downhill towards disorganization, disorder, noise, usefulness, finally disintegration, and ultimately death. Even the universe as a whole is heading downhill. The sun's going to burn out and the stars, eventually the universe will die what they call an ultimate heat death if it goes on like it is. That's the implication of the second law of thermodynamics, which is a universal law, just as the first law is. You might say that these are two laws which govern all processes. One is the law of quantitative stability. The total amount remains the same, but qualitative decay, the usefulness, the availability decreases. That's exactly opposite to evolution, which says everything is going uphill towards higher levels. This exactly predicts or confirms the predictions of the creation model. It fits exactly what we would expect from the creation model. It does not fit the evolution model at all. Now you can summarize these two laws in fairly simple terms. Conservation of energy is the first law. Decay of energy, unavailability of energy, is the second law. And of course, you don't have to express these in scientific terminology either. You can express them in terms of everyday experience. You know, for example, in your everyday experience, if you let things go, they go down. If you let your room go, it'll go toward disorder. If you let your car go, it'll rust out. Let your house go, it'll disintegrate. Let your body go, it'll run down. And even if you don't let them go, you try to take care of them, they're going to run down anyway. Eventually, because that's what the second law is all about. Everything tends to go downhill, not uphill like evolution would require. It seems like the evolutionists have a real problem here. The basic laws of science seem to preclude even the possibility of evolution. Oh, but then the evolutionists will reply that, yeah, but you creationists, you don't understand thermodynamics. You don't know that thermodynamics only applies to closed or isolated systems. Well, we understand that. But as a matter of fact, the universe is a closed system. If there's no God out there dealing with it, it's operating itself, so it's a closed system. And the universe is running down. That, they say that the universe, the whole of reality is evolution, but the second law says the whole of reality is decay in terms of what's really taking place in the observable universe. This can be illustrated in terms of, again, a time scale, with the vertical scale being order, just like we did when we defined the two models a while ago. And the first law is the horizontal line at the top indicating that the total energy of the universe stays constant. The vertical scale represents the total energy or information or organization of the universe. And the total stays the same by the first law. So that even though you can change the forms of energy, you can change electrical energy into light energy, for example, or chemical energy in the wheel and the gasoline and the mechanical energy on the wheel, you can change the forms, but you can't change the total. And so far as we know, this must apply to the universe as a whole, so that the total energy of the universe is a constant. But the available energy is running down, and that's the curve decreasing to the right there. And eventually it's going to come down to zero if it goes on long enough. It's heading down to zero. It's going to approach that sometime. And the significant thing is it isn't there yet. The universe isn't dead at this point. It's heading towards an ultimate heat death, but it isn't dead now. And therefore, there must have been a beginning. Otherwise, it would be dead. If the universe were infinitely old and it's dying in time, time isn't infinitely old because it isn't dead. Must have had a beginning, and so you can push this back to the back and see where the two curves cross. And that would mean the total energy of the universe is totally available at that point, and you can't go beyond that because, of course, you can't have more energy available than you have total. So that would be the beginning. That would be the point of creation. And you notice that the implication of these two laws, the first law says that the universe cannot create itself because in the present structure of the universe there's no creation taking place. But the second law says the universe must have been created some way in the past, otherwise it would be dead. And it isn't dead, therefore it must have had a beginning, like a great watch that was wound up and now running down. Well, how do you resolve that contradiction? You have to have a creation because otherwise it would be dead, but the universe couldn't create itself. Well, the answer to it is in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That's the most scientific statement anybody can make about the origin of the universe based on the universal laws of science. Now, the evolutionist doesn't like that, of course. And he will try to avoid that by saying, well, maybe back at the Big Bang, the laws weren't operating, and the universe was building up instead of running down. Or maybe he'll take the steady state theory and say, well, way out in space somewhere, energy is coming into existence to balance that which is running down. But remember, those are metaphysical speculations. They're not scientific observations. What we observe in the universe is quantitative stability and qualitative decay, and that contradicts evolution, seems to make evolution impossible. Let me read a statement from Dr. Van Wieland and Richard Sontag, and probably the most widely used textbook on thermodynamics. And when Dr. Van Wieland wrote this, he was dean of engineering at the University of Michigan, one of the great engineering schools of the country. And so he's an authority. And when people say that we creationists don't understand thermodynamics, they couldn't say that about these men. And so they say, does the second law of thermodynamics apply to the universe as a whole? Or the processes unknown to us that occur somewhere in the universe, such as continual creation, to have a decrease in entropy associated with them, and thus offset the continual increase in entropy associated with the natural processes known to us? If the second law is valid for the universe, now we of course don't know if the universe can be considered as an isolated system. Now, really it isn't isolated because God is there, but the evolution says it is isolated. Then how did it get into the state of low entropy? On the other end of the scale, if all processes known to us have an increase of entropy associated with them, what is the future of the natural world as we know it? Obviously, it's impossible to give a conclusive answer to these questions on the basis of the second law of thermodynamics alone. However, we see the second law of thermodynamics as a description of the prior and continuing work of a creator who also holds the answer to our future destiny and that of the universe. Now, these are high scientists who know the subject of thermodynamics as well as anybody, and they say the implication of the laws of thermodynamics is there must have been a creator who created the universe. And now it's running down, but he created it originally in a state of low entropy or high order. Well, okay, some evolutionists would accept the idea the universe as a whole must have been created, but then they say, well, in the framework of geological history, geological ages, if the Earth is an open system, there could be enough energy coming in from the sun to produce evolution over the geological ages, even though eventually the sun will burn out and the Earth will die and so on. But there's no contradiction with evolution on the scale of the Earth and the geological age system because the Earth is an open system. And the laws of thermodynamics apply only to closed systems. Well, now, when anybody says that, and this is the common answer that evolutionists give us when we say that thermodynamics contradicts evolution, they say, you don't understand that the Earth is an open system and the laws of thermodynamics only apply to closed systems. Well, they're wrong about that, you see. The laws of thermodynamics do apply to open systems as well as to closed systems. Anybody who says they don't simply don't understand thermodynamics. Now, they may think that they do, but they don't, because the laws of thermodynamics do apply to open systems. They just become more complex laws. Let me just read a statement from Dr. John Ross. I think when he wrote this was at Harvard. And this indicates that he understood that. He was an engineer. He says, there are no known violations of the second law of thermodynamics. Ordinarily, the second law is stated for isolated systems. But the second law applies equally well to open systems. You just have a little more complex equation. And let me read another statement from Dr. Arnold Sommerfeld. The quantity of energy generated locally cannot be negative, irrespective of whether the system is isolated or not, and irrespective of whether the process under consideration is irreversible or not. Now, the quantity of energy generated locally, that is inside of the system. Now, you can do things outside of the system to reverse that, or at least to compensate for it, but inside the system there's always a tendency to decay by the second law of thermodynamics. And so, it is true that under some conditions you can, for a little while, make things go towards higher complexity. But the laws of thermodynamics say that ultimately it's going to go toward lower complexity. And even internally, it's going to go that way unless you do something special to it for a little while. Now, it is true that the Earth is an open system, and we do have examples of open systems in which we have an increase of order. For example, you can take, a seed, which will grow up into a tree, or an embryo, which will grow up into an adult. Or you can take a pile of bricks on a construction site, and they will go up into a building. But in order to do that, you have to have certain conditions satisfied. Now, what do you have to have? Here's a closed system like the Earth. At time one, it's highly ordered. At time two, it's disordered. Nobody would argue with that because that's a closed system. But what happens if you open it up? If anybody knows the equation of thermodynamics, you know that if you have an influx of heat energy into an open system, it increases the entropy of that system, does not decrease it. As if there's nothing else there, it's going to increase the disorder of the system. If you have an efflux of heat from a system, maybe you have an increase of apparent order. But if you have an influx of heat energy into a system, like the sun into the Earth, you have an increase of disorder, increase of entropy, not the other way unless you do something special. Now, what do you have to do? What's really going to happen, you see, if all you do is open it up, is cause the system to become disordered more rapidly than it would if it were still closed. What do you have to make it work? Well, you have to have first an open system and available energy, but every system satisfies those conditions. Those are necessary but not sufficient conditions. In addition, you have to have a program to direct the energy. Like the case of the seed, you have the DNA molecule with the genetic code which directs it how to grow, or the blueprint for the building. And in addition to that, you have to have some kind of a mechanism to convert energy into the specific work of building up the structure, like the marvelous mechanism of photosynthesis in the case of the seed, or the electrical equipment and the muscle to the workman and so forth in the case of the building. And if you don't have both a code and a mechanism, you'll never have an increase in organization, even in an open system. And evolution has neither one, neither a code nor a mechanism, as far as anybody's ever been able to determine yet. So we're still able to say that the whole system of evolution is impossible by the second law of thermodynamics, and that's why you don't see it taking place today, nor any record of it in the past. There's no present evolution, no past evolution, no possible evolution. In fact, there's no evidence of evolution at all. If somebody wants to believe it, they have to believe it in spite of the evidence, and not because of the evidence. All of the real facts of science support the creation model perfectly and completely, and we don't need to apologize then for believing in creation. Well, thank you very much.